Tathāgata Sutra.
Good morning, everyone. This computer is really too big for the.
You get a lap thing.
Yeah, I have a new computer that I bought. It just has to come in.
Yeah.
It's a little smaller. It's a 15.6 screen. It'll be a little, like Jamie's, it'll be a little handier for these things. Anyway, so the story I'm about to tell you was originally told by the Buddha in a sutra, and it concerns a person who, while out walking one day, is confronted by a ferocious man-eating tiger. I'm sure that many of you know this story. They slowly back away from the animal, only to find themselves trapped at the edge of a high cliff. The only hope of escape is to suspend themselves over the abyss by holding onto a vine that grows at its edge. As they dangle from the cliff, two mice begin to gnaw on the vine they are clutching. If they climb back up, the tiger will surely devour them. If they stay, then there is the certain death of a long fall onto the jagged rocks below. Just then, they notice a lovely, ripe, wild strawberry growing along the cliff's edge. Plucking the berry and placing it in their mouth, it is unlike anything they have ever tasted before. So this week, Pam and I attended a conference for therapists where the keynote speaker was Claude Anshin Thomas, who I've mentioned before, a Zen monk who was ordained by Bernie Glassman. And then after his talk, he did the keynote session, there were breakout sessions run by several local therapy practitioners where mindfulness was a common theme. And I think some of what I'm going to say today I have said before, but I think it's so important it merits repeating. You know, mindfulness has become a buzzword in our culture. And that's even more true in psychotherapy circles. When you look at ads and websites for therapists, a very significant percentage state that they incorporate mindfulness in their treatment. All that talk about the importance of mindfulness led me to reflect on the way in which that term is being used and applied in the many secular contexts into which it's being imported these days. However, let's begin by looking at the contextual shift that's occurring when mindfulness is exported from its place within the matrix of Buddhist practice and introduced into applications for stress reduction, physical healing, and psychotherapy, among others. At its most fundamental level, if our practice as Buddhists is to be awake, then mindfulness as an expression of our wakeful state is absolutely essential. We must be present, we must pay attention, and we must bear witness to the panoply of phenomena as they arise in the world. At Treetop, our most fundamental practice involves counting the breaths, using our breathing as a simple, omnipresent tool to focus on. This is one of the first fundamental differences between many adaptations of mindfulness and Zen. From a Zen perspective, we focus on breath for one reason, because it's of its convenience as a vehicle for practice. We don't sanctify the breath. Yes, it's important for sustaining life, but that has nothing to do with its role in meditation. We focus on it because it's convenient, because it's there. And to do more than that creates yet another attachment. Secondly, in Zen, our emphasis isn't on following the breath. It's on being aware of and letting go of the thoughts as they arise. That can sound like a subtle distinction, but it's very important. We can be practicing effectively without reaching 10 even once if we are paying attention to our thought digressions and letting go of the thought chains that arise in a diligent, prompt manner, simply returning to the breath. There is no goal of stopping our thoughts. In fact, in Zazen, there is no goal at all. We are simply developing the basic mental disciplines of paying attention and non-attachment. That's it. I think that the idea that paying attention to the breath has special qualities comes from other meditative traditions such as yoga. The second place that Zen might take exception with some mindfulness programs is with regard to the relative value of mindfulness itself. Those programs see mindfulness, being in the present and appreciating this moment, as an end in itself, the goal of practice. I don't believe that's true for Zen, however. As I said, Buddhism and Zen are about being awake, being present, and paying attention to this very moment. However, that isn't an end in itself. When we are awake and present, it creates an opportunity. The opportunity to be present to the suffering of others, to bear witness to that suffering, and to allow a compassionate response to flow through us. That is the way of the Bodhisattva, the way of Mahayana Buddhism. Ultimately, our practice should not aim at our personal liberation, at the release of our suffering. We must awaken for all sentient beings. In the Eightfold Path, the Buddha speaks of right mindfulness. I believe that refers to the necessity of acting in the face of the circumstances that are before us in a way that manifests compassion and works to relieve the suffering of others. We must allow our consciousness to reach beyond the narrow sphere of our own needs, opening in each moment to those of other beings. We must be aware of circumstances, of our actions, and of the consequences of those actions. That is right mindfulness. We can practice right mindfulness in every moment of our lives. We don't have to be sitting on cushions in the zendo or walking in a Kinyin line. In fact, our ability to relate to the suffering of others and manifest compassion is extremely limited under those circumstances. We need to practice right mindfulness in our homes, our workplaces, our schools, our neighborhoods, and so on, everywhere that we are confronted with the reality of suffering. That is not to say that when we are diligent about being present to this moment, that we don't experience many wonderful awakenings. Sunrises and sunsets, the opening of a flower, bird songs on a spring morning, the smile of another person. Each is a chance to awaken, to intimately connect with the marvelous reflection of this remarkable reality. However, there's yet another way in which I believe that mindfulness programs miss the mark. By suggesting that we watch the breath, they imply, perhaps unintentionally, that there is a watcher, someone who sees the breath. In one of the sessions we attended on Wednesday, the presenter went even further, suggesting that we watch our reactions as we practice watching the breath. That is most certainly what we would call adding a head on top of a head. In Zen, we do not want to cultivate the watcher, which is just another manifestation of separation. We don't talk about watching the breath, we talk about being the breath. If we truly become one with the breath, there is non-separation, intimacy. So let's return to this poor person that's not been hanging over this cliff while I've been rambling along here. So there they are, hanging all of this time, suspended between death from above and death from below. In that moment, why does that strawberry taste so differently? Because hanging, suspended above the abyss, they are suddenly completely focused. There is no past, present, or future. No one tasting the berry, and no strawberry exists at that time. Just the explosion of flavor filling the whole universe. It is much like a mountain climber in the present day, suspended far above the valley, dangling from a rope. Nothing exists outside of the rock, the rope, and the movement of their body. They aren't thinking, what if I fall? Or what will I have for dinner? There's just mountain and the movement in one harmonious rhythm. That is why many climbers see their sport as having powerful spiritual moments. Aren't we all like this person in the story? Hanging suspended, death awaits us, although we might not know precisely when and how it will happen. If we truly let go and live this moment deeply and intimately, we can taste our strawberry, our life, and it is incredible.
I was thinking this week of the ways that, you know, the way, you know, in sort of conventional ways that we use to sort of creating a sense of freedom, or for instance, and a lot of it is, it doesn't have anything to do with Zen, doesn't have anything to do with realization specifically. But there's a real drive to have a sense of freedom that comes out of, I don't know, You know, for me, I've been bicycling this summer, and I just have been enjoying a lot. But I also found there's something about that puts us on a cushion. And there's a you know, in some ways, I don't know if this is to the point at all of what you're saying, but I think there's a connection. Or else it's just something I wanted to talk about.
Mentioned that back in my 20s, I wrote a song that tells that story of the strawberry and everything, because I read that in Paul Rep's book. And but then I didn't play it for like 20 years, and I forgot most of the lyrics, and I've been kind of upset recently because I wanted to play it again. I had forgotten most of what I wrote, and I sort of wrote it in a moment of jubilation, just a lot of energy, and so I have it. I want to rewrite those other parts. I sort of have to get back to that space in which I wrote it the first time.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were talking about the way in which things get watered down, I think, in part. And I mentioned this last night, but I had my students read the first 25 pages of Buddhism, Pure and Simple. And one fellow in there, a very bright guy, said, well, you know, this business about looking within, I look for the Lord. And he said, and the whole thing about living in the present, he said, Pepsi has a new ad, which is called Drink Pepsi, Live in the Present. Mm-hmm. And he said that, you know, that's what it sounds like to him. You know, I'm actually interested in the past, he said. I'm actually interested in the future, what's going to go on. And living in the present, he didn't quite say this, is a form of mindlessness. And, well, I could have agreed with that, it is a form of mindlessness. But no mind. So that's a challenge for me as a teacher of how I'm going to tease him beyond that view of the Pepsi living in the moment. That implies that the strawberry is there in your refrigerator at any moment. And of course, in some ways, that's not untrue. But it's substituting desire for liberation.
I think part of that problem arises out of this sort of sanctification of the present. You know, we can study the past by being present and really studying the past. We can plan for the future by being present and really planning for the future. Being intensely involved and intimate with each moment doesn't mean we can't study history or, you know, engage in strategic planning or, you know, any of those things. It means hopefully that we do those things really well with our whole being. The same way that rock climber. You can't be a half-hearted rock climber, you're going to be a dead rock climber, I mean, a mountain climber, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's about being whole, you know. And maybe that's the resolution for this guy, you know. And he needs to understand, well, I'm saying, don't ignore that. You know, it's like, you know, that the thing, you know, he who ignores history is doomed to repeat it. No, we got to pay attention. Let's pay real attention. You know, we got to, you know, that sort of notion. So again, I see that coming out of this sort of set, little sanctifying. Oh, I'm in the present. Big fucking deal, you know?
I think
something with the present. That's the thing. You know?
Yeah. I think that's the huge thing right now in sort of the pop cultural zeitgeist, you know, is like, you know, and maybe it got borrowed from like Ram Dass, Be Here Now, but it's like, you know, Eckhart Tolle with the power of now. And, you know, I got a really good chuckle at Bernie's little joke about like, if there's anybody who's not here right now, please raise your hand. Because, you know, we're always here right now. It's just the degree to which we're engaged, you know. You know, we can distract ourselves to death. And, you know, I think that part of your student problem, Peter, is that, you know, there's this archetype of the person that doesn't care about the past or the future. You know, they're just sort of, all they care about is right now. And, boy, you can fart away your whole existence that way. You know, just fritter it all away. But I think that's just another form of distraction. I think that's just another form of intoxication that we can... you know, that we can give ourselves to. Oh, I have to have the best experience right now. I remember being that way in college, you know. I'm just angry all the time because I wanted these, like, spiritual mountaintop experiences, and anything that didn't sort of live up to that was, you know, wasting my time as far as I was concerned. So, you know, I missed a lot. I missed a lot. Fighting for a big experience of right now.
That's how we justify the hedonism of the studies. I mean, you know. Again, right here, past the joint. You know.
I also think it's instructive that people who have completely lost their short-term memory have lost their memory are drifting all the time. They have no grounding at all. And so the past and the future actually serve that purpose for us. As we move from the past into the future, I mean, that is a universe for us. And someone who has lost that universe is completely at sea and therefore distressed extremely.
I think I've connected, and this is a small thing, but I think I've connected what I was trying to do, trying to say, and you came up with it when the sanctification of it, and I think we carry these sort of sanctified thoughts around, and so, you know, what Zazen offers is allowing that maybe. You know, some of the substantiality of that stuff to empty out and just say, and allowing response in the present. But the whole thing is, it's allowing response in the present and less more like, I'm responding in the present. Maybe. So, maybe.
Yeah, it's also a matter of letting down your barriers.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're setting yourself up to have this great experience, you're kind of, you know, digging in and saying, I'm going to get my cup of coffee and I'm going to sit out and watch the sunset and I'm going to really enjoy that.
Yeah.
But if you let go of all the other stuff,
yeah,
and just do it, then that's when you're going to really experience
it. I read this great article in The Onion where it was like, man apologizes to girlfriend for completely substandard sunset, right? So they go out to watch the sunset and they've got it all set up that it's going to be this beautiful experience, and then they're disappointed because it's like, oh, this is the suckiest sunset I've ever seen, you know? We do that to ourselves all the time, don't we? You know, I go on the same camping trip 3 or 4 times a summer, and if I set it up every time that it's going to be just like the first time I went, boy, I'd be pissed off a lot.
Yeah, and you know, Dan and I just had an interesting conversation about Shikantaza. And for those who may not know, Shikantaza is a meditative form that literally means just sitting. It means just sitting. And sometimes it's called choiceless awareness, or described as choiceless awareness. Just being there. And as Dan pointed out, Steph used to say that Shikantaza was impossible. And I think the way that Steph was understanding it as sort of having this sort of perfectly open field of awareness, he's right. Try doing that for 12 seconds and see how far you get. You know, that puts breath counting to shame, because, you know. But if it's just being there, with all the good, the bad, the indifferent, we're present sometimes and we're daydreaming sometimes and we're there, you know, then I think it becomes completely possible, you know. And it's always a very different practice, so Dan was pointing out to me that he's reading a source now, a commentary on the Genjo Koan, that sounds very much like that. You know, it sounds very much like just being present, you know, sitting with whatever, not that perfectionism. But you can look at other sources and it sounds very much like, you just got to got to be absolutely right there all the time. You know, interesting. I think there's a lot of power to Shikantaza.
Coming back to the present, Steph several times told the story of him getting stuck for months on what is the nature of this very moment, and I can't remember how long he was stuck for.
Eight months,
yeah. And because he was thinking that the moment is moment, there's actually a moment.
In a beginning and an end? A defined, discrete thing?
Yeah. It's vanishing. If it ever appeared, it's vanished. So we want to hold on to that and let's stay in the moment. It's just another way we have, you know, holding on to something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Creating permanence out of impermanence. Mm-hmm. Trying to hold something. There's this moment. I can hold it. No, I can't. It went. It's gone. Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, and I think, I hope it came across. I mean, you know, I'm not saying that there aren't, you know, wonderful, you know, but it's kind of like Jamie's just discussion of the sunset. We can't predict those and we can't hold them. They come and go when they choose, you know. And if we're attached to some outcome, then we'll miss the really beautiful moment because we're pissing and moaning about the... You know, about the one we didn't have. And so, you know, we just have to let go. We have to let go of those if we can. Yeah.
That's one reason I've never been an enthusiastic photographer, is because you're always putting something between yourself and whatever is there. And I think that a lot of photographers miss a lot because they're trying to capture something instead of just, you know, being present to it.
Then again, it could be a form of really looking, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's how Dido taught it. And, you know, he taught mindfulness. I don't think he called it that, but, you know.
Real photographers do not take pictures of their dinner and send them to all of their friends.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I'm not talking about you.
Yeah,
photographers.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's a more deliberate process. Mm-hmm. My son is using photography as a way both to focus and to avoid.
I can totally relate with what you're saying with it. I've never been a photographer. Like, I'm never, it's just like recording the experience. For me, I definitely put distance there.
But yeah, I think that's probably. I think that's probably especially true in our sort of smartphone era. You know, there was this really brilliant YouTube video sort of skewering our relationship with our phones these days, says the person recording this on her iPhone. You know, we're like, there's this really like, you know, there's a guy laying in bed with his girlfriend and they're both on their phones and things like that, but then, you know, you see a bunch of people at like this really intimate coffee shop sort of concert and they're all like recording it on their phones, and you know, I can see it being a way to avoid engaging.
Yeah, that's a level of abstraction where it's just, you know, kind of stepping back from the reality.
Well, Sherman Alexie, poet, Native American activist, wrote a very funny poem about Facebook essentially ensuring that we all live in our high school yearbook books forever. I mean, that's essentially what it is, you know. Oh, you're signing. Well, there's the person that you knew in sixth grade, and they're writing you a little note. Now, people do get a lot out of Facebook. It's just, but it is a vast time. My dear wife is being sucked into it slowly but surely. Can't go to bed at night before checking what her children are doing. And I don't want to know what my children are doing. Big events, so check in.
Probably sleep better that way.
Yeah, she has a lot of trouble sleeping.
And there's our teacher on his phone.
I just thought I'd check my email over.
Because I saw this new t-shirt, it's a parody of Surratt's Sunday in the Park, where everyone is out there in the park, but everyone's got
Okay. I'm ready for tea.
Creations are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless, I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless, I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless, I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it.